Alrighty, so Adam, welcome today. And a lot of people don't know this, but Adam is also one of our presenters on the Govology.com platform for some of our cybersecurity training that we do. We have both individual on-demand courses that are about 60 to 90 minutes, but we also do a major deep dive cohort, which we're also getting ready to kick off in October. And I want to post that and plug that a little bit because it's a really great program. And I just put the link there, govology.com/CMMC. But what a lot of people don't know is that whenever we bring trainers to present with us on Govology, we don't just want to get some education. We want to get really the best education from some of the best people in the industry that are really helping out in a big way for small businesses that are needing to implement some of these various things that they're learning from the Govology platform. And I spoke with a number of companies before I came across Adam and his company. And I just really loved your guys' story, Adam, because you guys are a spinoff from Haight Bay and Associates, which is a large, well, you guys are a small defense contractor yourself on that side of the house. And basically, you created Totem Tech to help other small businesses navigate and manage all of the stuff that you guys had such a hard time doing. So can you share a little bit about your story and the way that you guys came about?
Yeah, you hit it on the head. We need you to come market for us, Carol. You know our story as good as we do. And we're small, but we do large things, I guess you could say. So Totem Tech, like you said, is a spinoff, a daughter company of a government prime contractor, but we're a small business prime contractor. In fact, I would call us a micro business. We're 14 employees. It's called Haight Bay and Associates, as you mentioned. And in 2015, one of the co-owners of Haight Bay and Associates sat down and wrote a proposal for a small business set aside by the Air Force for logistics support. So maintenance, repair, overhaul, and shipping, and some field type of repair activities for an Air Force weather sensing system, a tactical weather sensing system. So it can be moved all around the world, in fact, and set it aside for small business, the logistics aspect of that. So myself, the owner, Aliyahu Bay, we call him Ali. He's the Bay in Haight Bay and Associates. And a couple other folks put some input into a proposal. We had all been working on the Air Force program when it was executed by a large prime contractor, Textron Systems. In fact, some of you all may have heard of that company. We had worked there, and we all left to form small businesses to actually go after the set-aside. And we really didn't know the odds that were against us as a new startup coming into government contracting. We didn't know what we didn't know. We were very fortunate to write a winning proposal, have a winning price sheet, like, you know, winning lowest cost, technically acceptable proposal. And since 2015, we've been executing that contract. And so my background is cybersecurity, so I was brought on to do the cyber part of this Air Force system to harden that and protect it from our adversaries. So that's been my background since 2009. But in 2016, I got wind of the requirements for contractors, federal government, and specifically DOD contractors to implement cybersecurity safeguards, standards, best practices. We call them controls. Implement controls in our own privately owned IT system, the IT system that we use to manage all of the information about this Air Force system. It's not an IT system that we sold to the Air Force. It's the one that we use ourselves, like our laptops, our desktops, our servers. And we had to harden those and protect them from adversarial attack as well. And when I looked at the requirements, I realized how complex they were and how much of a challenge it was going to be for us as a small business to implement, not only from a time and labor sort of resource standpoint, but also from money, from a cost standpoint. It was not going to be cheap. So it was a requirement for us. We had no option. We had to implement all this stuff. So we started right away. And in the process of that, we realized that our experience and our expertise, if you will, we could lend that to our peers, our other small businesses, especially micro businesses. So under 20, 25 employees, they were really going to struggle with this. So we formed Totem Technologies in 2017. So shortly thereafter, to bring our experience and our expertise to our peers. That's a rough sketch, a rough overview. There's a lot that goes in between that, a lot of hurdles we overcame, a lot of successes. We've had great CPAR scores since the beginning. In terms of Air Force weather, we've been called by the contracting officer team, the program management team, a model program for Air Force Weather. So we're very successful on the Hate Bay side. And I would say likewise on the Tone Tech side. So happy to be on with you guys. It's good to see you again, Carol. Good to see you again, Michael. And
awesome,
appreciate
man.
The chat.
We love that from the trenches approach that you bring in. And in this particular episode, that's what we kind of want to unpack is just like you're a new contractor out here. Maybe you just can, maybe you're not a new contractor, but we're going to get to a lot of questions. I want to go to Michael real quick, you know, before we really kind of dive deep into the questions and say, Michael, I know you got a big network yourself with folks that you guys work with. What are you seeing in terms of like some of the big challenges that some of your contractors that you work with are having with cybersecurity?
It's a good question. And as we were saying just before we started, I feel like Adam and I have kind of been in a Groundhog's Day type of moment. Every time I see him, we're having almost the exact same conversations for literally the last 3.5 years of, hey, this is coming. Hey, this is going to be an issue for small business. Hey, you got to get prepared. And then they just kick the can down the road. So like a lot of our clients have just said, I don't care about this. I don't want to know. Like, I just, I'm not concerned about it. To a degree because of how many cans have gotten kicked down the road. So I'm interested to hear from Adam today and hear what his insight is yet again on where we think we are, what we think is going to be coming out over the next year or so, what that looks like. Also as well, do you think the can's going to get kicked down the road again? You know, what does that impact look like? Because it's funny because we've all known cybersecurity is such an issue. We've talked about it. It was a big deal around the elections. It was a big deal around all kinds of different things. And yet this is something that the government just keeps going, I don't know. Let's just move it. Hey, there's 50 things. No, there's 75. Oh, I don't know how many things you need to do. like, I mean, that's how it feels like watching the cartoon from inside of like, what is actually going on? Who knows anything about this and how to make it work, right? So I'm really interested to hear from Adam today on what he's seeing. As somebody who's been working in the trenches, and can give us some updates because for our clients, it's just been like 3.5 years of, we got to do this. Oh, wait, let's put it on pause. We got to do this. And like, we've had clients working on security plans, going through self-assessments only to like put the brakes on and then restart and put the brakes on and restart. And so there's just so much confusion right now. It would be really helpful to kind of clear some of that up. So,
yeah, I'm happy to do that.
And I think on that point, Adam, maybe that would be a good place to start. And I know one of the things that Michael's referring to is the CMMC thing where it kind of keep, and that's the DOD kind of requirements around cybersecurity. But just in general, I mean, there is a lot that people probably don't even realize that it's not only the DOD that's requiring cybersecurity. You know, if you're doing business with any state and local government agencies, we're seeing them in some of the things that we've actually gone after, and you'll see
and other federal.
Yeah, and other federal, agencies. You know, the VA has now like some pretty stringent requirements with them. So if you could, I guess, like, how do you make sense of this whole big picture? If I was to tell you, Adam, that, hey, I want to do business with all state and local agencies and all federal agencies, where do you start to break that down and maybe kind of in your mind put together like a some type of a overarching plan of security or maybe a cone of security or something like that that can help you across all of your contracts.
The cone of silence.
Like the cone of silence, right?
Yeah. Well, that would be jumping right into the deep end, I think, like starting to talk about developing these plans. Let's talk about the basics. I want to address, and Michael, there has been a can, a single can that's been kicked down the road, and that's this thing called CMMC. We can come back to that and talk about that. That's essentially for the Department of Defense, it is the stick that the Department of Defense has to beat us, the supply chain, over the head to get us in line to say, implement these cybersecurity standards so we stop hemorrhaging data to the adversaries, China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, organized crime. That can has been kicked down the road a little bit, but the overarching requirements, the things that we have to do that will be held accountable for under CMMC, they have not changed. In terms of basic cybersecurity, those requirements haven't changed since 2013, I think, was the last change. And for the more advanced requirements, cybersecurity safeguards for another a different type of information. Those haven't changed really since 2016 or so substantially.
And it all boils down to what type of information do our company expect to handle as part of executing a contract? With the federal government, all of us, no matter what, no matter where we are on the supply chain, whether we deal directly with the federal government agency, Department of Energy, Homeland Security, DOD, Department of Education, VA, we all handle something called federal contract information. The acronym for that is FCI. The definition for that is almost literally all information related to a federal government contract that hasn't been explicitly authorized by the federal government to release to the general public. I'm talking all information. So your emails back and forth to your customer, whether that customer is the federal agency direct and you're a prime, or you're a supplier, vendor, subcontractor to a prime and you're communicating with the prime, your email communication about that contract is going to be considered federal contract information. The contract itself, the purchase orders, delivery orders, task orders, subcontract that you flow down, those will all be considered this federal contract information. There's one exception to that general rule of what constitutes FCI, and that is what's called basic transactional information. So like the invoices that you submit to your customer, that's the only exception for what's not considered FCI. Everything else is, and by virtue of working anywhere in a federal government supply chain, you are mandated by a FAR clause. Your audience is going to be pretty familiar with what FAR is, but I'll spell it out. Federal Acquisition Regulation, the sort of contracting Bible. There's a specific FAR clause, 5204.21, that requires us to implement some basic cybersecurity protections to protect that FCI. That hasn't changed in a decade, that requirement. How the government holds us accountable for doing so is a different story, and we'll talk about that when we talk about CMMC. And so if you think of FCI as this big circle, in a Venn diagram, there are certain types of FCI that are a little bit more sensitive, that require additional protections, not rising to the level of sensitivity of like top secret or secret, like James Bond level type of information, but unclassified controlled information, what's called CUI, controlled unclassified information. It's a subset of FCI. So in the Venn diagram, you're looking at a smaller embedded circle in that FCI circle. When we encounter the CUI, we have to put some additional protections in place. That requirement to put additional cybersecurity safeguards in place has been around since 2015, 2016, and they have not substantially changed, those requirements. What has been in flux and what has been frustrating for a lot of us that work on in the federal government supply chain is, especially with the DOD, how the federal government and the DOD plans to hold us accountable for meeting these contractual requirements. That's the CMMC, the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification. That's been in quite a bit of flux for the last 3 years. There's some updates to that for any of your audience that's been paying attention to that. I can go through those updates today. But that's the bottom line. It depends on what type of information you're going to handle. The type of information dictates, mandates, obligates you to put in place some cybersecurity protections. And those requirements, which by law you are obligated to if that clause is in your contract or flowed down to you through like a purchase order or something, or reps and certs, you are mandated by law to put these protections in place. And that hasn't changed for quite a few years.
Yeah, and that can be a bit confusing, right? And that's one of the things that I was hoping we could help to uncover on the call today for the folks who are showing up and watching this video. If you're out there, how do you know if you're going to be required to meet compliance, and what can you do to start preparing at the basic level? I know that a lot of time, maybe all the time, probably, it's always kind of in the solicitations, and sometimes it might not always be spelled out. Sometimes it might be incorporated by reference with some of these cyber requirements. So I guess one tip would be to you just make sure whenever you're looking at your solicitations, if you see anything with regards to cybersecurity, make sure you're taking that into account. But then there's different levels. And I think that's what we're looking at with the CMMC of a level one, of a level two, of level three certification. And I guess the more sensitive the information, the higher level you would need to comply with. Within that CMMC is a mix of these FAR clauses and the NIST 800. And can you help to explain that to folks?
Yeah, I can. So we mentioned the basic cybersecurity requirements for protecting FCI. Those requirements will be called out by a specific FAR clause, either in full or by reference in a contract, flowed down, and the prime contractor is required to flow down that clause, that requirement through subcontracts, reps and certs requirements, purchase orders, delivery orders, those sorts of things. They're required to flow that down. So if you see this clause, 52.204.21, I forget the exact title of that clause, but it's something like basic cybersecurity safeguards. And so you can also search that term cybersecurity in the flow down, the contract, subcontract. That clause being in your contract, and even to back up a step, Carol, if you are starting a business or have a business or are pursuing work in the federal government supply chain, period, you're going to be subject to that clause, those requirements for the protection of that FCI. These requirements range from, they're called basic, and they are kind of basic. Like, it's things like you must have, require a username and password to log into your IT systems. It's kind of like no brainer. Like, there's no Windows laptop that doesn't require that out of the box. There's no iPhone that doesn't require some sort of PIN or something to get logged into it. So you have that kind of requirement. There's a requirement to protect your physical buildings that your company operates out of, with doors and locks, or locks on doors and windows, surveillance, access control into the doors. So making sure that only authorized individuals can enter into the building where the federal government information is handled. And then there's a sort of like, that's a physical end of the spectrum, and a digital or logical type of protection. And there's 17 requirements, basic requirements that fit somewhere in that spectrum. Those are the basic things. They'll be called out by this particular FAR clause. That's for federal contract information. If your organization is expected to handle, so that means store, process, or transmit, that more sensitive subset of FCI that we call CUI, that's controlled unclassified information, then the agency will explicitly in contract make the prime contractor aware of that, and also require the prime contractor to flow that requirement down in full, so not by reference, the full text of this clause down through the supply chain. The DOD, so in the Department of Defense, and the Department of Defense is really the tip of the spear when it comes to protection of controlled unclassified information right now. They are leading the charge in terms of a executive branch agency and getting their sort of ducks in a row, the supply chain secure. And the DOD will include a clause, DFARS 252.204.7012.
And by the way, you can Google any of those clauses as well if you want to look up the and read the reference, which we suggest that you do.
Yep. And it's supposed to be included in full in contracts and flowdowns. And that is the clause that is indicative that as a member of the supply chain, you will be encountering the CUI and are therefore obliged to protect that CUI. And there's two main sort of umbrella overarching sub-requirements in this clause. One is to provide adequate security for CUI. The other is to be able to recognize cybersecurity incidents. So recognize when you're under attack and report that to the DOD so the DOD can help if they need to. That first sub-clause, adequate security, in the DFAR 7012, it says you will provide adequate security by implementing a NIST standard. NIST is National Institutes of Standards and Technology. They have a series of cybersecurity publications, and one of their publications is the 800-171, which is a list of 110 safeguards, 110, that we must put in place to protect that controlled unclassified information. So it includes all those basic safeguards I mentioned before, like usernames, passwords, antivirus protections, physical security of the building, and adds an additional 93 or so safeguards on top of that. So I saw a question in the chat from Malcolm, is 52.204.21 the clause that makes contractors comply with NIST 800? It is not. It's the DFARS 252.204.7012 that obligates us to implement the 800-171 for the protection of controlled unclassified information, CUI. You mentioned, Carol, that this NIST stuff, like 800, like where does that all come from? That's specifically called out in DOD contracts right now, although there are other agencies that do refer to NIST 800-171. Department of Education does, Department of Energy, Homeland Security does, but the DOD is the furthest along the maturity path in terms of like calling specific things out in contract clauses, applying them across the supply chain. I'm not saying they apply it at the right places all the time. Like they pretty much are just boilerplating DFAR 7012 into all new contracts. And that's unfortunate, but that's another topic we can talk about.
You bring up a really good point here that I think most people, if they aren't hearing this clearly, you need to hear it. Actually read your contract. I can't tell you how many people reach out to me and say, hey, Mike, we won this contract. We've been doing work for a year, 2 years, 3 years. And the contracting officer just asked a question. And man, they're not going to like our answer to this question. And we went back and looked in our contract. And sure enough, this was in there. I can't tell you how many times something like that has happened to me where a client reaches out. I mean, you got to actually know the rules of the game, or at a minimum, know what you're signing off instead of just saying, it mentions that FAR XYZ is part of this contract. And you go, I don't know what that is, whatever. And you just move on. That happens a lot.
Imagine like a baseball, like a pitcher going out to the mound and not knowing about the new pitch clock or like balk rules. I know I'm getting like baseball nerd talk, but imagine that. Like your job as a pitcher is to know that. Your job as a contractor is to know your contract inside and out. Yeah, Michael, 100% agree. We take it very seriously. We have to. We're a prime. There will be four or five of us at Hey Band Associates out of a company of 14 that know the contract inside and out. And I could like point to clauses in there almost by memory.
How often do you think people get audited on any of this stuff? How often do you think some people get caught where they're not following it? Do you have any horror stories on this or anything like it? Because I personally haven't heard any. And I think that's one of the reasons people have, for the most part, not completely, but for the most part, ignored cybersecurity until CMMC came on the scene. And then people were like, oh, going to take this serious for once. Yeah. And we've got to start doing so. Because I mean, like most people understood, even if it wasn't for the government, they understood we need usernames, passwords. We need a lock on the door or somebody's going to steal our stuff. So like there was a lot of those really basic, maybe not 50 things, but there were some really basic things people are already doing to safeguard just their business and information. But I don't think a lot of that has been intentional until the last decade or so. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, hey, you'd be surprised on how many of us don't lock our doors and windows. We do audits for our clients, and especially I get it in Southern California. Let's leave the doors and windows open and the garage bay doors open, but you can't. Like you have federal government information in there. You're building parts for a DOD weapon system. You can't just leave your garage bay doors open. Like I get it, whether the weather's nice. How often are folks held accountable? Not often at all, Michael, in my experience. There's something called the False Claims Act, which by virtue of signing off on your contract, wherever you are, prime contractor or three, four, five, six tiers down in a supply chain, like a mom and pop running a machining shop out of their garage, wherever you are, by virtue of signing purchase order, delivery order, submitting an invoice, you are acknowledging the mandate that all those clauses are in your contract. And by acknowledging so, if you don't fulfill those mandates, if you don't meet your obligations, the federal government can take you to court. And the minimum punishment coming out of that would be like you lose your contract, but there have been fines that have been levied for false claims in the past. There are more, but the ones that come to mind in recent memory is less than a handful, less than five, fewer than five. False Claims Act against companies that did not meet the cybersecurity obligations. It's extremely hard for the federal government to find that out unless there's been an egregious breach of information and they know that source was the company. And right now, the only method they have to hold us accountable is a self-attestation, a self-reporting. Like in terms of CUI, there's actually a portal for that the DOD set up that you have to go perform your attestation in terms of implementing the 800-171. But for the FAR 52-204-21, it's just by virtue of signing the contract, you've agreed that you have this in place. We do see more and more lately. So over the last three or so years, the prime contractors really stepping up, like I said, to get all their ducks in a row because they know this is coming. And if they lose, especially like a sole source supplier, that program that they manage is going to come to a screeching halt. So they have been sending out memos and questionnaires like Excel spreadsheets, Word documents that require the supply chain member to affirm that they have the FAR 52204-21 covered. Like, that's a no-brainer. And if you can't affirm to that, we've had prime contractors say, well, we're not going to send you another purchase order until you can. That's typically when our clients come to us or one of our peer consulting companies, like with their hair on fire, like, oh, the money's going to stop coming in until I can answer Northrop Grumman affirmatively, right? Or Raytheon or Aerojet, Rocketdyne. And we say, okay, well, let's go through this questionnaire. And they're typically deficient, even in the basic cybersecurity protections, not to mention the more advanced stuff for the protection of CUI. So right now, it's only this sort of self-assessment affirmation type of answer a questionnaire for a prime contractor. That will change when the CMMC fully comes online. And that's this thing that has been frustrating for a lot of us, because the DoD has been, like you said, kicking this can down the road and making a lot of the industrial base, a lot of your clients, think that it's not real. The mandates already exist. It's just the method that the DoD will hold us accountable for meeting those mandates. So
pretty wild. One of the things that I think is interesting is I usually see there's two types of contractors. There's contractors that have never had anything to do with the military, anything to do with government contracting, anything to do with a security clearance. There's those folks. And then there's folks like myself who had a very high level security clearance. And most of the time, you see the cleared folks who treat the information very differently. Even what you would consider irrelevant data that you can find online, you treat it very differently than some of those folks. But I also see people with high security clearances who, they use password as their password,
Or they store classified documents in their garage or their bathroom.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's one of those things where it really, there's no way to predict who's going to be good or bad at it. It's just, it's having the safeguards in place and having people trained on it, which that to me is one of the things where folks are talking about the checklist of, again, we'll just say passwords, doors locked, all the things that you need to have, but then it's really only secure as the person on the team who follows it, right? Or doesn't follow it.
Yeah, the users bear a lot of the responsibility. There are technologies that we can put in place that sort of take the burden off of the users. A great example is antivirus software on your laptop or on your smartphone or whatever. But the bottom line is the user, the staff, your company's staff is always going to have some kind of responsibility when it comes to this. And so that means that training your staff is a huge component of what we call a cybersecurity program, the implementation of all these safeguards, not only to meet the requirements, but to do a good job of protecting the information that we are handling for our customers.
Do you actually see CMMC coming fully online in 2024 and like the can not getting kicked down the road anymore?
It's looking more and more like the can will stop being kicked down the road. It'll either be late 2024 or some in the industry say maybe early quarter one calendar year 2025. Mm-hmm. There will be a new clause that the DoD has to be able to put into contracts. It'll be 252-204-7021, not to be confused with 7012. 7021 will be the CMMC requirement. So for the notion of CMMC, this sort of stratified model of accountability for cybersecurity protection, that notion was introduced by the DoD in 2019-2020 timeframe. And Pentagon was gung-ho to implement this thing, but industry pushback, political pushback, executive branch realizations of the complications of something like an accountability model pushed the brakes on that. Industry comment, so public and industry comment, forced the DoD to refactor the CMMC, which they did in 2021. Since then, the Department of Defense is reworking the proposition, the proposal to the executive branch for the CMMC, because it has to be approved by the Office of Management and Budget before it can be published to the public for public period of comment. Once the public period of comments is over, then the clause will be finalized, the rule will be finalized, and you can actually put it into contracts. Prior, from 2021 until now, the DoD has been working on this rule and talking about it and playing it up. But as your clients, as you can attest to some of your clients' reaction, a lot of us in the supply chain have been like, well, we'll see if it's going to be a real thing or not. It's getting closer to a real thing. So in late July of this year, the DoD submitted the proposal to the Office of Management and Budget for review. That's a huge step towards CMMC being a real thing. There'll be a review period by OMB. That'll take a couple of months. After that review period, OMB will publish the proposal in the Federal Register, and then it's our chance as a U.S. person to publicly comment on this proposed rule through comments in the Federal Register. Depending on the format that the rule is published in, dictates how long the public period of comment is. It could be as quick as 2 months. More likely, it's going to be a public comment period of like a year, maybe. But after that period, the rule will be finalized, and then the DoD has that clause and can start holding us accountable. And we'll see that clause 7021 show up. It'll be phased into contracts, only new contracts. No existing contracts will be modified, but we'll start seeing it in RFPs and RFIs. The prediction is sometime late 2024. So as close as I've seen it to being a reality since it was conceived, Michael, in 2020.
Do you think there's a chance for them to add it to like do a contract mod for option year contract? So I just want a 5-year contract. I'm in the middle of, you know, year two. This thing goes in going into year three. Are they going to do a contract mod to that and drop this in there?
I think that is a possibility. Yeah. And we have a 5-year IDIQ. That's how we've been operating since 15. And I would anticipate seeing a task order or something come down with this new clause once it's available to the DoD. So we're preparing for that as a microbusiness prime executing IDIQ. We are preparing for that possibility.
So you bring up the question on everybody's mind here, probably the last 42 minutes. If I am a small business, what is your advice that I'm doing right now to prep for this?
Start right now. Even the basic stuff, as I've mentioned, not all of us are even doing the basic stuff. And even some of the basic stuff is challenging. Like you'll have to do something called a vulnerability scan of your environment, even if you only handle FCI. I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole what that means, but it requires technologies that most small businesses don't currently have. That's for FCI. If you handle any kind of technical information for the federal government, especially the DoD right now, because DoD is piloting CMMC, any kind of technical information, so drawings of a part that go into a DoD weapons system is an example of technical information. We generate reports on our logistics and repair that are of a technical nature. If you handle any kind of technical information for the federal government, especially the DoD, start now implementing this NIST standard. Our clients' average implementation time from scratch, from start to getting close to full implementation, is over a year, and it's closer to a year and a half. It's not something that a small business can do overnight because there's so much to do. None of it is impossible. A lot of it is challenging, and implementing 24/7 monitoring of your IT environment, that's not something that even most businesses, whether they're large or small, that aren't in a regulated environment do. Putting technologies and really humans in the loop to monitor, looking for bad guy behavior, that's a requirement for controlled unclassified information. Not something most of us do, and a challenge to implement, both in terms of time and money. And so the earlier you start, the better. Let's say you haven't done anything and all of a sudden you find this CMMC clause show up in a contract. It's not something that you're going to be able to do in months even, let alone days or weeks. And the typical, I don't know what you find, Michael and Carol, but the typical are the proposals that we've submitted are approved between 2 and 3 months, awarded within 2 or 3 months of RFP issuance. So you're not going to be able to implement 800-171 in a matter of months. So the earlier you can start, the better.
And that's one of the things I also wanted to touch on too, Adam, because I see a lot of things where I call them showstoppers, where folks will all of a sudden they see the solicitation and they recognize there's this requirement in there to bring themselves into compliance with. I don't know if you've seen that be a showstopper from agencies not awarding a contractor a contract because they couldn't show them a specific type of
accounting system or something.
Yeah, or cybersecurity requirement that they've got in place. But like you were saying, I mean, the sooner that anybody can get started on any of their compliance, the better. not only do we not want it to be a showstopper for people, if that becomes a showstopper in terms of like contingency upon award, you have to have this, right? And then the second thing is like, you don't want to go with your hair on fire either at the same time. You want to start to kind of implement this over time into your business, so it's just not such of an impact on the team. Yeah. But the question that I've got related to this, and the question that is on everybody's mind most of the time, is just like, okay, I see that this is going to be something that I need to get on board with. It's relevant to every contractor that's doing business, and sometimes at different levels. But what do I do now? What is the cost of it? We are promoting our CMMC workshop, which we have coming up in October. And I know we've been doing that for a couple of years now. And a lot of the contractors that we've done it for really like it. It's not free, but it's a nominal cost. And what we wanted to do was to have people be able to operate over a series of weeks where they're learning a little bit and they're implementing with your guidance along the way. So that's what the big question is in terms of, you know, as we promote this workshop, where do people find themselves after they get through it? And do you think that this is going to save them a lot of money in the process? Because that's what we're really trying to do, is to kind of take something that, when I was having conversations with some of the early cyber firms that I talked to that were doing this, and they were talking like 60, 70, 80K for small businesses, we try to bring that down. So what is the anticipated outlook on the cash layout, and how can you get it done in the most efficient and economical way?
Great question. I can talk about, and I'm happy to talk about what HateBay, our recurring fees are to maintain compliance. But let's talk about like, where do you start? Because that's the question. It can be overwhelming looking at these requirements. The place to start is to really identify what types of information you either currently handle or plan to handle on the contract, what we call scoping. So get an understanding of how FCI and or CUI matriculates in your environment. How is it received from your customers or from upstream in your supply chain, from your suppliers and vendors? Or do you generate it internally? Who internally uses the information to do something with as part of their job, their daily job? What other companies or organizations or people do you have to send that information to do their job external to your company? How do you store it short-term and long-term? So shameless plugs, but in the workshop, we structure the workshop to lead the participants through those first steps in the order that they should be taken. So scoping is the very, after you understand like what the clauses are and what they all mean and what they're asking for, the first step on the journey, the compliance journey, is to do the scoping, understanding where the information is or where it will be, and try to reduce the footprint. The more that you can limit where this information goes within your organization, the easier the implementation of the cybersecurity safeguards will become. I'm not going to say it's easy, but it will become easier. And as with most things in life, the easier they are, the less it costs and the quicker it can be done. There's a lot to unpack with scoping and like determining where information is and where it will go, but we have a structured sort of exercise that we go through with our clients, a sort of thought exercise. And we gather all the stakeholders together and say, all right, there is a list that's published by the federal government, actually, of what constitutes controlled unclassified information. Let's take a look at this list. Do you handle any of these types of information? Yes or no? That's the first step. Okay. For those that are yes, who does something with it and how? The folks that are listening, and Michael, your clients, if they can start thinking about where the information is and how it moves throughout their environment, that it's definitely the first step. And it's really half the battle to try to understand and shrink that footprint. Awesome. I'm happy to go into costs.
What we might do is I'm going to post the link to the workshop again, which starts October the 2nd. That's a 9-week cyber compliance workshop where Adam covers the DFARS, NIST 800-171, talks about CMMC. But I know there's a lot of really great information in there. Do you have somebody on your team, if we put the link, that if they wanted to give you guys a call to ask questions about the workshop and everything?
Absolutely. I'll put my email address in the chat, but also put info@totem.tech. That mailbox is monitored by several of us.
Okay, awesome.
I'll put that one in there first.
Also, while you're doing that, I saw a comment that was put there by Sydney Beam and mentioning kind of your comment back about if they add in a requirement within like your IDIQ contract, say that if they add it, be sure that you don't accept it without proposing a cost adjustment if it's going to drive new costs for you. And I think that that's a good point.
It's a good point. I'm not particularly hopeful that that will work, but so we will definitely do that to our program office. But the DoD has stated that the implementation costs of 800-171 and meeting the DFAR 7012 are not reimbursable. They are allowable. We could conceivably renegotiate our standard fees, our labor rates, and G&A rates, but we're not going to be reimbursed outright with some sort of CLIN, some sort of contract line item for the implementation.
But yeah, that is a great point, because I think that whenever you're looking at it, whether you're in a solicitation now, and that's why it's important to read like in totality the solicitation, is because there's a cost associated with compliance. And like Adam said, you can't build in a line item for that, but sometimes within that G&A or other areas, or that might just have price your proposal a bit differently with understanding that you've got these costs that you've got to account for. And I think it would be fair for the government to give the contractors a shot at saying like, hey, all of a sudden, boom, here it is. Like, this wasn't in your original award, but here we are 3 years later, and now you got to comply with all of this stuff.
And just to be clear, the costs of the assessment are allowable. It's not quite clear if the costs of implementation are allowable or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, they will be part of your overhead. You all, Carol, have some great accounting workshops and course material on Govology as well. It's been very useful for us.
Awesome. Glad you guys are enjoying that. Thank you. So, Michael, do you have any last words? I know we're kind of getting towards the top of the hour, and we're going to shift over into the Q&A to take some questions. But do you have any last questions or comments?
One of the points that Adam brought up earlier is, as this goes through the process, a part of the process is it'll show up on the Federal Register for comment. The average thing that shows up on the Federal Register for comment gets a total of a whopping 3 comments. And that is often a disservice to the whole community. In fact, I think Josh and I are usually 2 of the 3 comments on a lot of those things, so, which is kind of funny. But that is your chance as a contractor to influence how this thing is going to be implemented. Take that chance. And when it comes to not just what's going into the final rule, but as Adam was just talking about, like, it's not reimbursable, but it is allowable. You can complain about anything in that. I mean, it's an open forum for, you don't have to stick to anything. You can write a book in that thing. And if enough people do it and enough people influence it, then you will see some changes to it. So that's really my plea for everybody in the final comment here, is actually be part of that process. Don't just sit on the sidelines and watch it unfold. Get on the field in the game, make some comments, reach out to people, whether it's Congress or whoever. You know, you can reach out to people in your state and say, hey, this is coming down and this part of this is not right, and we need your help to fix these kind of things if you feel that way about something. I'm not saying you will. Who knows how it's going to be crafted? But the biggest thing that bothers me a lot of times is people don't get involved in the process and then just complain on the back end. And we wouldn't have to complain as much if more people would get involved and actually be part of the process. That's really my encouragement to you. Be part of the process. So
100%.
Awesome.
That's my soapbox for today.
Awesome. Thanks, Michael. And you know, whenever you need to hop off, you can. Well, we're going to shift a little bit here. So for those of you guys who have joined us for the live stream and on this main version of the show, thank you. We're going to shift into some questions now. I had a question come in to me directly, it looks like. And by the way, there's a couple of ways that you could ask questions. Just use that little raise your hand button on your control panel. You should see it under the reactions on your bar. You raise your hand, we can, and just unmute your mic and ask your question. There was somebody that said, could you ask about enclaves? And I'm not sure what she was referring to on that, but you have any ideas?
Yeah, enclave, that's a sort of jargony term, or actually the more complex jargon would be something called an isolated security domain. That's what NIST calls it. Colloquially, I guess we would call it an enclave. That is where you carve off a portion of your IT system and isolate your controlled unclassified information, or your FCI for that matter, to that sort of separate part of your IT system. Lots of ways to accomplish that. The way that we see more and more, and in fact, Totem actually offers a secure CUI enclave all in the cloud. So we say, okay, we're not going to handle, for those of us that can manage this, we make a statement like, we're not going to handle any CUI in our on-prem environment, like on our servers, in our server closet, or on directly on our laptops. We're never going to store a CUI file on here for various reasons. The main reason that we would make a decision like that is because it's expensive to secure laptops. It's expensive to secure servers on-prem. Why don't we leverage the cloud? Microsoft manages their servers in like Microsoft 365 or Azure, their cloud service. It's their responsibility to do the heavy lift on securing those things. We can save some money, and we say we're only going to handle our CUI in a secure cloud environment. Totem actually offers one of those environments. We call it ZCaaS, Zero Client as a Service. I'll type that in the chat. If you feel like Googling that, you can take a look at it.
This is very relevant because the next question I was going to read you is the compliance process simpler and less costly if we use a cloud-based system like Teams?
It can be, but you have to understand that none of the requirements go away by using an enclave. Enclaves can make the implementation of the requirements easier and cheaper. A lot of people are frustrated by cybersecurity folks because our answers to a lot of these questions, Carol, are it depends.
Yep.
Or they start with true. It depends. And I know that's frustrating, but it really does depend. It really depends on the scoping, how your information is going to flow through your environment. If you are in a fortunate enough position to say, I'm only going to use Teams for our controlled unclassified information, that is an option. You will be paying more for that from Microsoft because they have special tiers of Microsoft 365 that are secure enough for controlled unclassified information. The commercial environment is not. So you have to bump up a tier in Microsoft 365 for which you'll pay more. But there are strategies like that that you can leverage cloud's services for enclaves. Yeah. Google Workspace is another great example. I see Joe type that in the chat. Google, very recently, so I think it was last year, had their workspace, if it's configured in a particular manner, called assured workflows or assured workspace, something like that. You can actually use Google Workspace for CUI as well. So you can make an enclave in the Google environment. It's not just Microsoft. You can use Amazon as well, Amazon services.
And is that something that you also talk about in once folks get down to the workshops, kind of how to select?
We do. In fact, the workshop, as you mentioned, is 9 parts. It's a 9-part series. We stretch it out like that so it's not too intense and it gives you plenty of time to do the work that we suggest you do during the workshop. And if you do put that work in at the end of the 9 weeks, you'll come out compliant with the current requirements. But anyway, the very first lesson in that workshop, we do something called a deep dive at the end of the workshop where we go down rabbit holes. We explore some of the jargon and we talk about which cloud services you can use and why and how to know if you can use a cloud service for a particular type of information.
Awesome.
That's lesson one of the workshop.
I got another direct question, and maybe it was a comment, but this could open up a whole another can of worms because we talked a little bit about this a lot. So the comment is, how about warning about companies advertising solutions, but misleadingly are only part of the solution? So I want to say this too, and with this caveat, because you and I, Adam, have talked a lot about the big push for Project Spectrum, which is a DoD solution in itself. It's not a private company. And there's a lot of businesses that are kind of being directed in that area. But in the span of all of the resources out there, it can be very confusing. I mean, you could hire a company and pay them a lot of money and not even get to where you needing to go. On the other side, you can use some free resources maybe, but maybe don't close the gaps either. So is there a way you could talk about that in a very really kind of summed up kind of way?
It depends. There is no silver bullet for protection of federal government information, period. There's no single technology that you can buy or cloud service that you can use that solves all your problems. There's no company that can solve all your problems with some sort of suite of services. No matter what, even if you're just a one-person organization, you're going to have to take some responsibility for the management and implementation of the cybersecurity program because technology is only about 50% of the problem. The other 50% is you have to write out your strategy. You have to literally document the strategy. You have to document how the cybersecurity program works. You have to be able to provide evidence that it is working, that it's effective when the time comes for assessment, when the CMMC assessors come. And you can hire consultants that can help you with that, but they can't take responsibility for that. Like you can't outsource fully a cybersecurity responsibility to a third party. Just like you can't outsource your company's reputation, or maybe more concretely, you can't outsource your company's safety program. It's going to be very apparent if OSHA, do they have agents? Like, I know they have folks that will come do investigations for workplace safety, but I don't know what they're called. Yeah. An OSHA representative will look for what's called institutionalization, look for the company inculcating, imbibing something like a safety culture. It's going to be the same for cybersecurity. You're going to have to, and institutionalization is the word that the DoD is using.
Yeah.
You're going to have to institutionalize cybersecurity. So there, you can get help, a lot of help, from third-party consultants like ours, from using enclaves like Zcash or Teams or something like that. But ultimately, the company has to own and manage all of the policies, and that's half the battle.
Yeah.
What we do, Covology and Totem and Michael does as well, is coach on how to institutionalize.
I can see how that answer that you just gave with it depends can be so relevant, because, I mean, and it doesn't just apply to cybersecurity, but a lot of times when we're trying to get folks like, quote unquote, procurement ready, you know, to kind of be ready and have all of the readiness that they need. It's really all based upon the opportunity. And so when contractors are out there, there may be one opportunity that they're putting a proposal to that may require a lower level of security than another opportunity. So yeah, it's always going to probably change depending upon the opportunities. And I remember something when Ali came on and did a webinar with us that he said, he's like, I don't even think I want to go to level three. I don't think I'm going to just no-go all level three things, you know, which kind of also is a decision point on like, okay, hey, there may be some smaller things that doesn't require as much that you could do, but there's things that you might get involved with that are very high secure nature that's going to require you to go like a lot higher of a level, yeah, of security posture, right?
Yeah, he was talking about CMMC level three. So
yeah,
there's three levels. Level one is the basic stuff for FCI. Level two is for CUI. And then level three is for what I call CUI plus, or like enhanced. So like, yeah, Ali, that's our CEO, Ali Bay. He said, we're not going to pursue contracts for like hypersonic missile fleet readiness or fleet logistics, because that would put us at CMMC level three, because we're just not interested in that level of intense cybersecurity program management. We'll be at level two, and we'll be fine with that. And those are the opportunities that we'll look at.
And I think that's a great takeaway there too, because it makes people realize that, hey, yes, this is going to be a little bit of a thing to implement in the business, but at the same time, you know, there's a lot of opportunities out there that you can get that level one or level two and be just fine, and don't always have to go to the highest security level. So when you see some of these really stringent requirements, they may or may not apply to you, but it's always should be in the solicitation and in the clauses what does apply.
So there's a silver lining to CMMC in that it will be a certification. You'll get assessed every 3 years, have a new certification at least every 3 years. But for that 3-year period, you have this cert that you can hand off that shows the government everything they need to see. It's actually very similar to like a quality certification, like ISO 9001 or AS 9100, one of those types of things. Like, that's a requirement in the contract, but as soon as you have an AS 9100 certification, you can propose on any contract that has that as well.
Yeah, that'll be the nice part where you get to that, where you know, hey, okay, I've got this certification, and here's what I need. There's a couple more questions if you have a little bit more time.
Sure.
So the first one there, how much ongoing support will you need after emerging from the workshop fully compliant?
Oh, that's a great question. So, and this is an important point. I see that from Malcolm. That's a great question. Cybersecurity is not fire and forget. Your cybersecurity program, your institutionalization, will need constant care and feeding in perpetuity for as long as you plan on handling this federal government information. And so you'll need the support. Most of us, including Hate Bay and Associates, need the support of what are called managed security service providers. Providers of which Totem Tech is one, shameless plug. Security support providers that provide continuous monitoring of your environment, looking for adversarial activity, alerting you when adversarial activity is taking place, and then helping you fight back those adversaries and helping you report to the necessary authorities. That's an example of the care and feeding type of activities that you have to do. So it's, your job isn't over once you've become compliant or get a CMMC cert because you have this care and feeding. I can talk a little bit, Carol, if you feel like it's a good time, talk a little about expected costs of that.
Yeah. And while you talk that, I'm also going to read this question to you because I think it's also relevant is, you know, they say, how is a single member firm expected to comply with this at a price point that they can afford? It sounds like the requirements will result in hiring additional staff.
Hiring additional staff or outsourcing to a managed service provider. Most micro businesses will rely on that second option.
Yeah. And that's why it's good to know your cost up front, because when you're looking at these solicitations and the clauses within them, and there's a cost of compliance, you know, like Adam was saying, I mean, you can't line item it, but it's going to be a consideration on the price that you put in your proposal to the government. And if you don't build it in somewhere, and later on they come and say, hey, you were supposed to do this. Sorry, you missed it, but you're going to probably have to complete performance of this contract at a loss. It could happen to you. So that's why we're really passionate and trying to get some good information out here. So Adam, I'll let you kind of just go forward with what you were going to mention before I kind of read that last question.
Yeah, these are all relevant questions and comments and topics. The bottom line is at CMMC level one, or if you're only going to handle that federal contract information, the basic type of information, you can still expect care and feeding costs, annual costs for maintaining a program to be somewhere in the low five figures, somewhere between $10,000 and let's say $30,000 annually just to maintain a compliant program. When you start talking about CMMC level two, when your organization is anticipating handling controlled unclassified information, those numbers jump up in order of magnitude. You can expect low six figures, 100 grand around there, in annual care and feeding costs for a cybersecurity program. These aren't just arbitrary numbers. I can back these up with data from ourselves, which is going to be the most relevant or most visceral, I think, to you all. But also I have numbers for the hundreds of clients that we've helped, and they're very similar. So the bottom line is, if you are going to handle CUI on a contract, but you don't expect that contract to provide a couple hundred grand in revenue, you might want to think twice about it. Haight Bay and Associates, currently our care and feed of our program, our annual just maintaining the program, our costs are anywhere between $75,000 and $100,000 annually. What goes into that? Well, we pay about a third of that, between a third and a half of that, to a managed security service provider, a security operations center. This is a company whose sole reason for being is to monitor other companies for adversarial activity, monitor for cybersecurity attacks, let us know when it seems like we're under attack, that's their job, and then help us fight, figuratively fight that fire. They're called a managed security service provider, MSSP, anywhere between $30,000 to $50,000 annually. That's usually the most expensive part of the protection of CUI when it comes to care and feeding of the program. Next most expensive is licensing, especially for cloud services. So depending on how many employees you have, like if you're going to use Microsoft 365 environment, the federal government information environment, you're looking at annual license costs between $300 to $1,100 per person, depending on what that person's going to be doing in Microsoft 365. When you total that up, even with a 10-person organization, you could be looking at $10,000 annually, okay? Then whether you do this internally or you outsource to a managed service provider, the environment always changes. Your IT system changes. Technology gets old. You need to replace servers. You might win a new contract and have new types of information in another customer environment that you have to worry about. You have to factor in the nature of IT and that it's constantly in flux. That for us is sort of doing project-based, like keeping tabs with technology, even for a 14-person company, is $20,000 to $30,000 a year. So all these little things add up. Labor costs for like my labor to manage the program as the information security officer, my time has to be accounted for. So when you factor all that stuff up, you're looking at a six-figure problem, even for a micro business, to handle controlled unclassified information. As a one or two person shop, there are some efficiencies that can be realized, especially by taking advantage of cloud-based enclaves that can drop that significantly below 100,000, but still in mid five figure range. So even a one or two person shop can look at like $30,000 to $60,000 annually, most likely, to be able to handle CUI properly. So it's no joke. You really have to have your accounting, understand your accounting to know your revenue, know your costs, be able to accurately calculate overhead rates, it's not a small undertaking you're signing up for doing business with the federal government.
Adam, the last question I'll put towards you is, and this is just my personal curiosity type of question, but you know, as I was listening to you, this, by the way, that was a great breakdown on the cost. I think a lot of people have no idea in terms of like it being that costly, and just that little tip of information was so helpful, because now, again, as I said earlier, when folks are looking at these requirements in their solicitations, there is a cost of compliance that needs to be factored in. You can't just look at the line items that here's what we're going to do in the scope of work. There's a cost to compliance, and that needs to be factored in. I was curious as to know, have you had any contractors that know you guys are out, they're looking at this contract that they want to propose, they know that there's going to be a cost of compliance, and they reach out to you guys and say, yeah, hey, Adam, we're looking at going after this contract, we're finding these clauses, we want to do this, is this something like that we can do? And also, if we get the contract, what do we need to factor in about for a compliance cost on this? You got any contractors that reach out to you with that type of questioning?
All of them.
Yeah, I figured that, you know, but yeah. That would be so helpful. And that's something that folks that are on this call today, if regardless, workshop aside, they had something that they're seeing in their solicitation and they wanted to reach out to you guys.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Aside from the folks that come to us with the hair on fire saying, hey, like Aerojet is yanking my purchase orders, help. The next most frequent question we got are, can you take a look at this memo that we received or this delivery order? What does this clause mean? What does this mean for my business? And it starts this dialogue. It depends on the company, right? But it starts a dialogue and we can help start folks on their journey. Unfortunately, I'm in the position to, not frequently, but once in a while, have to break it to either current federal government supply chain member or anticipatory one and say, look, you probably don't have enough revenue or can't anticipate enough revenue to really implement it properly and pass the CMMC assessment. You're just not there yet. And that's heartbreaking. It's a heartbreaking part of my job. It's one of the reasons, like, I don't know if you pick it up in my tone, Carol, but I'm not a huge fan of the CMMC and this bureaucracy that's being created. I'm definitely a fan of protecting our information from China and Iran, right? Like, it's just the requirements are a one-size-fits-all requirement, and they're not differentiated for small businesses like I personally think they should be. As a small business, Haight Bay & Associates is facing the same requirements that Northrop Grumman is, that General Dynamics is, and I don't think that's fair. But it is what it is. There are efficiencies that we can realize. There's definitely a roadmap. In fact, we have something called the CMMC Compliance Roadmap at our website. So there's definitely a roadmap, and the road is navigable. If you think of it like a trail, like a analogy I use a lot is you're hiking the Appalachian Trail. Like, most of us could do that. It's just long.
Yeah.
It's not like climbing Mount Everest. It's just like hiking a long trail. So we can do it. Trail maps exist. Sherpas like Totem exist.
Yep.
But it's going to be a challenge, and I don't want to beat around the bush. Like, it's challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, then the other challenge is then who's policing the non-compliant firms out there that don't build the cost yet. So, and a lot of times that's industry having to police themselves and the other folks that they're competing up against.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was Malcolm wrote about the lowest price technically acceptable. Governments always, well, as long as they have lowest price technically acceptable as the criteria for the award, they're going to get the lowest price. How long does it take the government to realize that awardee isn't up to snuff? Supposedly the CMMC will solve that problem for the government.
That would be good, actually, because say if they could look and say, hey, okay, they've got the level 2 certification or whatever, that they know what that means. And I kind of see the writing on the wall that would probably become like an evaluation criteria for award or something to meet this basic standard.
Once CMMC is a real thing, once it is a clause, that will be a criteria for award. Yep. The DOD has stated it will be in all contracts.
Yeah. Well, hey, Adam, I appreciate the extra time you put in today to answer all the questions. If you guys have any questions about the workshop or anything else like that we're doing coming up on October 2nd, I believe that starts. I'll put the link there again. Feel free to reach out to Adam. He'll be answering the questions for you on that. Also, if you weren't here at the beginning, if you have a question on CMMC that pops up in your mind, Govology Nation, that's our private LinkedIn group, is another great place to go. The URL to easily navigate to find our group is govology.com/nation. That'll jump you over there. Just request access. And if I see a question, maybe if we missed anything or you guys have something else come up, I'll make sure I ping Adam, let him know that we've got a question in the group there on cybersecurity. So with that, Adam, do you have any last words that you'd like to share before we head out today?
I would just say, get started. Don't drag your feet. Don't listen to the naysayers. This is coming. And if you drag your feet, you're going to be behind the eight ball and in a world of hurt in terms of trying to do contracts. And I would say thank you very much to you and Elena and Michael. I'll follow back up with him. It's good seeing you all.
Likewise. Nice chatting. Yeah, this was awesome, man. Thank you for your time. I know we got a lot of great comments in the chat here. So thank you so much. And, you know, we look forward to seeing you on your other webinars that we've got coming up with you, where you're going to be doing some more updates. So I would tell folks, watch for those on the Govology platform. If you're already a Govology member, we'll get you some emails out on those. And then we've got, of course, the workshop, the deep dive coming up on October the 2nd. So we really hope to see you there as well.
We'll be at SBDC in Nashville next month.
So lots of things coming up. So you guys are at the SBDC conference. Look for the Govology Totem booth. We're going in together on that one. So as a teaming partner, and think that now you have a teaming partner in Totem, if you don't have one already, that you can help to help you look at these requirements and make sure that if you are going in this realm of a contract that has these requirements, you've got another great resource here that you can add to your team. So thank you, Adam.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.